Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese, and I am co-host of the channel with Carrie Figder. In our bi-monthly podcast, we talk with philosophers about their newly published books. Today, I'll be talking with Professor Michael Lynch about his new book, In Praise of Reason, which has just been published with the MIT Press. Michael is professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. There is a set of intellectual practices associated with the natural sciences that's devoted to the idea that our cognitive lives are properly managed when we base our beliefs upon evidence and sound reasoning. For simplicity's sake, we can call this set of practices the method of reason. The method of reason governs many of our everyday affairs. For example, when the car doesn't start, we look in the gas tank, or we check the engine, rather than offer a sacrifice to the gods of transportation. But one may ask whether the method of reason is appropriate as a basic cognitive policy for all areas of belief. Perhaps there are some matters where reasons and evidence simply don't matter. Perhaps there are other non-rational sources of cognitive guidance that trump the method of reason. Or maybe the method of reason is actually a kind of rationalization. Maybe the attempt to believe on the basis of our reasons and evidence is a kind of folly, because in the end, there really is no such thing as evidence. In his new book, Michael Lynch provides a thoroughly sensible and compelling defense of reason against these various kinds of skeptical worries. But the book is not a purely academic exercise in the area of philosophy known as epistemology. Lynch recognizes that questions concerning what we believe and when we believe are often bound up with questions of how we believe. And questions about how we believe are of central importance to the project of sustaining a civil, democratic society. That is, In Praise of Reason is a work at the intersection of epistemology and political philosophy. It is also a highly engaging read. Let's turn to the interview.
Hello, Michael Lynch.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks good, for good, having good. Me on the program.
Well, thank you for joining us. Today on New Books in Philosophy, I'm talking to Michael Lynch about his new book, In Praise of Reason, which has just come out with the MIT Press. As the title suggests, this book offers a defense of reason and rationality against various kinds of skepticism. Lynch writes in his characteristically engaging style, and the book will be of interest to philosophers and non-philosophers alike. Now, one of the most attractive features of In Praise of Reason, at least to me, is the way in which Lynch brings together considerations from epistemology and political philosophy. In a way, it's an attempt to give a unified account of the cognitive and social value of reason. His central thesis, if I understand him correctly, is something like this. It's that caring about reason and evidence and inquiry and getting things right in the broadest sense is essential to living and having and contributing to a properly democratic civil society. This seems to me to be a novel thesis, and I should also say one that strikes me as manifestly correct. But before we dive into the details of Lynch's view, Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this project?
Well, I'm, as you indicated, I'm naturally a professor of philosophy. I work at the University of Connecticut. I got into this project in a way through the back door. I've been working for a number of years on the nature of truth and sometimes from a very technical standpoint, trying to say what I thought truth was. But when I was thinking about truth, I started thinking about why we should care about truth. I mean, why was it important to be doing this work on what truth was? I mean, who really gives her, right? What matters about truth? And that led me to write a book on that topic. And I came to think that if you wanted to know what truth was, it was a good strategy to figure out what truth, why we should care about truth. And I think in general, that's a good strategy. If you want to know what something is, you should also ask the normative question, why does it matter to us? Because the answer to the question of why it matters to us can actually reveal something about what, at least what we think its nature consists in. So that's what I started to think about truth. And subsequent to that, I began to realize that a lot of what I had said about why truth matters to us was incomplete, because I had not sufficiently addressed the various why we should care about favoring certain methods for getting at the truth over other methods. I mean, it could come all, you know, we could all grant that, I suppose, in a society that at one level at least, most people just, you know, they do care about truth. The really hard questions, I began to realize, really come up when we start asking, but who has the best method for getting at the truth? And it was that conflict over methodology that got me interested in reason, because in one way of understanding that conflict, there are people that think that certain methods associated with science, call those the methods of reason, can access, get us to the truth, and that those methods in some sense trump other methods. And then there are other people in our society who might grant that science is all well and good, but that the methods of science are themselves trumped, at least with regard to certain areas of truth, by other sorts of methods, perhaps religious methods, perhaps more psychological methods. So that's how I got interested in this project that I'm involved in now.
Well, excellent. So just picking up on that last thought, let me read a sentence or two that appears on page 3 of the book, where you talk about the aim of the book, and I want to, because you in this this little passage, you mentioned two things that really are themes that run throughout the book, and I want to put on the on the agenda both of those things. So here's what you say: I will try to convince you, you're talking to the reader, that while skeptical worries are serious and in many ways understandable, they can be answered. Then you go on. Reason matters and appeals to reasons matter, and not just for the noble ideals of the academy, but for the down to brass tacks, mud on your boots world in which we all live. Now, I want to ask you about skepticism in a moment, but before turning to that, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the mud on your boots stuff. So could you, the book begins, in fact, with, and the book also sort of carries through in other parts, sort of these sociological data about crazy things that people believe, or crazy ways in which people go about either forming their beliefs or maintaining them or sustaining them in light of recalcitrant evidence or consideration. So I take it that you think that the knockabout world of people and politics and belief, that these are the real motivations in a way for the book, and that you're worried about the ways in which our fellow citizens might be going about managing their cognitive lives. Does that seem right?
Yeah, that is right. I'm worried not just about, but one qualification. It's not just that I am, of course, worried, I think, as we all are, about the fact that people might be, including ourselves, perhaps, right. are not managing our cognitive lives as well as we should be. I mean, I'd certainly own up to that. So I am, you know, of course, that's worrying. But I'm worried about the particular sources of this mismanagement. I'm worried about the fact that in certain respects, the mismanagement, as we call it, of our cognitive selves, our fact that we seem to be not paying attention to the appeals of reason or the uses of reason as much as we should, really have at this moment in our cultural development, certain sources that, while lying right beneath the surface of the cultural debate, and therefore sometimes overlooked, are nonetheless extremely important, are somehow forming, are the source of certain kinds of special mismanagement that are occurring now. So it's not just the fact that people, you know, believe crazy stuff. People believe crazy stuff for as long as there's been human beings. But the ways in which people are arriving at these crazy views and the their reactions to others who they believe have different views than their own. So let me give you some examples about that. So, I mean, you notice that the book begins with some data. So what's some of the data that you're talking about? I mean, take the case of evolution, right? So according to a 2007 Gallup poll that I cite in the book, something like 14% of those who say that they don't believe in evolution, which, by the way, is actually, so I'm talking about 14% of the people who don't say who say they don't believe in evolution in the United States, which is most of the people.
Right.
But only 14% of those folks actually cited lack of evidence as the main reason for holding their views about it.
Right.
Other polls indicate that, in fact, most people are aware that there's overwhelming scientific agreement on the truth of evolutionary theory. So it's not – what's interesting about that is that it's – you know, most people, they acknowledge that there is scientific evidence for evolutionary theory. It's just that this sort of evidence doesn't seem very persuasive to them when it comes to certain issues that they really care about. Now, there's a lot of different explanations you might give for that. One is the fact that science – we need better science education, maybe a sociological evidence that people aren't just in some sense – invested in the community of science. Maybe there's psychological evidence that might appeal to. Certain ideas just are difficult for people to understand, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those are very helpful remarks. But I think data like this also shows to another possibility that many people are, in a certain sense, implicitly skeptical about reason, whereby reason I mean, in this particular context, the methods on practices that we often associate with scientific inquiry. People are skeptical about that, about them. They're skeptical about whether they should trust them, those methods, when it comes to certain things that really matter to them. And so it's not that they don't see that there isn't evidence of this sort, scientific evidence. They're just wondering whether that sort of evidence is the sort of evidence that really has any persuasive or power for them. And they're a bit skeptical that it does. And in fact, it seems that they don't think that it is. Go ahead.
Right. So, and I also take it that one of the concerns driving the book is not simply, you know, that in our sort of individual cognitive lives, we, you know, recognize what the evidence suggests and then have some way of either dismissing the idea of evidence as such or thinking that the kind of evidence that scientists gather and deal with is not the relevant kind of evidence or not the right kind of consideration. But I guess that also the book also talks about climate change and other kinds of cases in which it looks as if there's a lot more at stake in what we believe in that if we deny certain kinds of things or don't you know, right. reject the idea of evidence or scientific evidence when it comes to figuring out what to believe about certain kinds of issues, the impact extends far beyond our own sort of interior epistemic or doxastic lives and actually affects, you know, affects other people or future generations or the planet.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, this sort of, so a lot hangs, it seems to me, on practical things. Practical things hang on, obviously, on what methods of belief we employ. I mean, obviously, I mean, from the questions that you just raised to, you know, in some sense, more banal cases. So, you know, cases about trying to decide, for example, what's going to go in our textbooks. Everybody at the table, let's say in the Texas school system, might say that, look, we're interested in putting the facts in our textbooks. And that's important to us. It's a matter of policy. We want our children to be educated. We want them to learn the truth. The question, pretty quickly, though, we start debating over what those facts are. So, for example, is evolution to be understood as factual, as something that can be put into a science textbook? But the interesting thing about debates like this, debates over global warming, debates over evolution, debates over, let's say, the MMR vaccine, these debates quickly ratchet up, it seems to me. They move up what I call the epistemic ladder to debates over whose evidence, who has the evidence to best support their view of the facts. And then, of course, once it reaches that point about questions of evidence, it can ratchet up still further and become a debate over whose methods for generating evidence are the most trustworthy. Is the best way for learning about the past history of the planet, for example, abduction or induction from the fossil and historical record? Or is it rather consulting a particular book, a sacred text? There's actual real disagreement about which of these methods is the right one. And I think those of us, particularly, you know, those of us who are sort of see ourselves as part of the broad scientific community, and those of us who also see ourselves as part of the left, have a tendency, I think, to dismiss this sort of debate. We tend to say, I tend to find that a lot of people will say, look, people have crazy methods. What are you going to do? You know, I can't deal with people like that. That's a real mistake. It's a mistake epistemically, and it's a mistake politically. Because if you just dig in and refuse to take seriously the challenge to your methods and the reliability that is being made in certain parts of our cultural discourse right now, you open yourself up to being held up as an example of the dogmatic, of the dogmatist. Right. So Santorum on the campaign trail back when he was campaigning for president, he one day remarked, you know, he said, the conservative, the GOP, we're not enemies of science. We're not the anti-science party. We're the pro-truth party.
Right.
He says, it's our duty to make sure that the claims that scientists are making are verified as true. Now, that's a really interesting claim. I'm paraphrasing the last bit, but
right.
It's a fairly quick paraphrase. Very interesting claim. The thought that they're not anti-science. It's just that. So what is he saying? What's the thought there? The thought is, well, these methods that the scientists are appealing to, well, we're not going to be persuaded that those are necessarily always the best methods.
Right.
We have other methods for getting at the truth.
Right.
Very interesting. And it shows how this abstract debate over it that does quickly get very abstract over epistemology and who has the best methods for getting at the truth over reason, that really does have a cultural impact right here and now.
Right, right. And just picking up on this, so in what you were just saying, I think that you showed very nicely the ways in which sort of what we might think of as sort of two – maybe they're not two distinct kinds, but sort of two types of skepticism are connected. There's the sort of more sociological kind of skepticism, like the the man on the street sort of, you know, I'm not going to let scientists tell me what's what. You know, they're just, you know, geeky guys in lab coats. You know, I've got other methods right. or other sources. So there's a kind of sociological sort of skepticism that manifests itself as a kind of non-deferentialism
right.
to science and reason and evidence and the rest. And that is, you know, not, you know, it's continuous with the more standard skeptical views that we as philosophers, you know, deal with, the Sextus, you know, Pyrrhonic worries about justifying methods. And so in the book, I think you make a nice transition back and forth between the more philosophically nuanced skeptical views about methods and dogmatism and digging your heels in and right. arguing in a circle, those Agrippa trilemma types of right. concerns, and the more sociological stuff. And I take it that you think that the philosophical, the nuanced kind of skepticism admits of a kind of powerful response on behalf of reason. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because,
sure.
you know, that's part of the book that, although still being accessible to non-philosophers who might read the book, I thought was philosophically kind of exciting.
Thank you. Yeah. So let me first frame what the problem is that you mentioned it. And let me just expound on that a little bit and then start talking about what I think we can and can't say in response to this sort of skepticism.
Great.
So, I think that the subtler source of skepticism that you're talking about is this. I agree the sociological and the one I'm about to describe are connected, but the subtler one is basically this, that we can't seem to give reasons for our trust in certain methods of reason without
right.
running in circles.
Right.
Right. And the way that manifests itself in the culture is how do we, you know, the somebody like Santorum says, well, how do you defend your trust in science on some particular matter? Are you going to just, how are you going to answer that? Are you just going to do more science?
Right.
That seems to be a problem. The way this arises in more traditional context could be understood as just a sort of a problem about first principles and how we justify first principles to each other. If we think of a basic belief-forming method as a method which is basic precisely because we cannot give any argument to show that it's reliable that doesn't employ that method, then we can say that certain what we might call epistemic principles, first epistemic principles or fundamental epistemic principles are principles that announce that such methods are reliable. And the problem is, how do we defend such first principles? Principles like, in an obvious sense, deductively valid inference from true premises is a reliable way of expanding your knowledge. How do we defend that is logic is reliable without using logic? That's the point that the skeptics always raised. It seems that we have a finite amount of methods, finite amount of principles, and once the skeptic challenges us to defend one of the principles, it seems we have to appeal to another principle. And eventually we get down to some principles which we can't seem to defend except in terms of themselves. And that, it seems to me, is at heart a very, A, philosophically important and historically important problem, and B, really what's at root behind a lot of the skepticism that's pervasive in our culture. So how do we answer that problem?
Right.
Well, my own sort of thought is that we have to admit there's some truth to the skeptic. We have to admit that I am not going to be able to give you, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, give you a reason, an epistemic reason for accepting my fundamental epistemic principles, unless you've already accepted that reason and those principles. So if you challenge some fundamental epistemic principle of mine openly and demand me to give an epistemic reason for its truth, a reason for its truth, I will not be able to do that if it's a fundamental epistemic principle. And the skeptic argument, I think, shows that that's the case. But what that, however, does not mean that we have to conclude that there are no reasons for such fundamental epistemic principles, because there are different kinds of reasons. There are epistemic reasons, reasons for believing that a principle is true. There's also practical reasons, reasons for committing to certain principles, that is, taking them on as premises in our future reasoning, future arguments, trusting those principles. There's practical reasons I can give for committing to a principle. And what I do in the book is to try to show that we can give, moreover, objective practical reasons for committing to certain epistemic principles over others. The big picture way of thinking about this is as follows. What I argue is that scientific principles of reason, scientific first principles, are rational to trust over other sorts of principles because they have certain democratic virtues that other sorts of epistemic principles that we might entertain don't have, or they have more of those virtues. And so while I think, you know, we've traditionally wanted to sort of defend the rationality of our epistemic methods, our basic methods, by appeal to something, you know, to something epistemic, I think we need to give up on that project and recognize that what we have to do is show that our epistemic principles are reinforced by our moral and practical principles. That doesn't mean that they're not rational. Indeed, it means that they're just means they're rational in a different way than we might have initially expected.
Okay, so good. So let me just ask sort of a philosophical concern with this line.
Sure.
What do you say to people who say they're not practically interested in having a democratic civil society with you? Right. Maybe they're interested in having a democratic civil society with their fellow religionists, for example. So does the idea that we justify our fundamental epistemic commitments by appeal to practical considerations about the kind of social order we most would hope for, does that generate some difficulty in dealing with people who either want a different kind of social order or might want the same kind of social order you're interested in, but just not with any old person, but with only a particular kind of person?
I think, right, there's two questions there. There are two different types of people there. The one who might want a slightly different social order than myself.
Right.
One who just says, screw social order with you in general. You know, I mean, you know, I just can't deal with
you philosophers or you academics.
You know,
or,
just can't deal with you. You know, you're just too weird. And just leave us alone and we'll form our own society. Now, to this second sort of person, you're right that the sort of strategy that I'm using to try to show that a certain sort of epistemic principles are more rational will have some of its force blunted if that person is willing to insist that they have no interest at all in what I would call certain democratic virtues of tolerance, openness, and an interest in treating other people with a certain amount of respect because they are persons. If they're not already committed to those sorts of values, you're right, it's going to be difficult for me to bootstrap some epistemic principles in the way that I'm talking about. So what that shows, though, I think is, and in a way, what I want to say is, well, that's right. I mean, this book is an attempt to show why, given certain, you know, assumptions that I'm taking for granted, we can still nonetheless argue that our epistemic principles are rational. I think, I mean, given the sort of question that I'm talking about, I think it would be very difficult, in a sense I've already conceded, that it, you know, if we assume nothing, if I assume nothing, then it's going to be very difficult for us to continue to have any sort of conversation. Either with ourselves or with anybody else. So some extent, of course, I want to acknowledge that, sure, we've got to take certain things for granted. When I say that we need – when I celebrate in the book the importance of giving and exchanging reasons for our positions, I'm not saying that, far from it, that at some point in certain parts of the conversation, we have to assume and take something for granted and move on from there. But I am saying that what we got to be open to, with the right attitude, the right epistemic attitude that we have to have, is one according to which we take questions like the ones that you just raised seriously. So when, you know, that is, we got to be willing to take certain things for granted, like I did in this book, take certain premises for granted. What am I taking for granted? That we're working toward, that the reader of the book is somebody who's interested in, like, in working towards a civil democratic society. If they're not, then, okay, now we need to switch to a different sort of strategy. That's right. But the differences between myself and that person aren't going to be limited to the epistemic, as I say in the book. I mean, you're not interested in democracy, and my differences with you aren't really epistemic issues, first and foremost. They're political and moral issues, and it's there that I think we're going to need to start our discussion.
Right. Well, excellent. So I want to get back to this epistemic issue about first principles in a minute, but let's take a slight detour, because one of the other really nice parts of the book, I thought, was the discussion of the relation between reason, or our faculty of reason, or the practices involved in reason giving, the relation of those things to other, what we might think of, or traditionally might think of, as sort of non-rational or pararational capacities that we have. So, as you know, and as you describe in the book and explain in the book, the long tradition in philosophy of thinking that reason has an opponent, actually, within the human psyche, in emotion, that somehow reason and emotion are these two distinct kinds of capacities, or distinct kinds of forces, within our lives, as Plato portrayed them, as sort of two horses sort of vying for control over the chariot, which is the human soul or the human psyche. And a long tradition of philosophy has it that these two things are distinct, they are opposed, and something like the good life consists in giving control, or ensuring that control is in the hands of reason and not emotion. There are, of course, counter traditions which reverse that picture. And then there are other kinds of positions which try to strike a balance between them. But I would say that the majority of the philosophical tradition, at least in the canon in the West, has it that these are two opposed things. And the trick is to somehow, you know, negotiate their relation. But you've got a slightly a different picture, in that it seems to me that you're not sure that they're opposed, even if they may be distinct. So can you tell us a little bit about your views about the connection between reason and emotion, for example?
Sure. I think you exactly summed up my basic position by when you said that I think that even if these are in some sense, of course, there's a difference between reason and emotion, that they're not as opposed as our traditional pictures would have us believe. Let me say a little bit about why I think in the present context, too, that we've been talking about, including the political context, this question really matters. I mean, it matters independently as a matter of philosophical psychology. It's of intrinsic interest. But it also matters because what we were talking about a moment ago is this sort of general skepticism that's a pervasive in our culture about the thought, and which could be summed up this way, that reason always gives way to something arbitrary. At the end of the day, reasons give out. We have to take something for granted, as I myself was acknowledging before. And that just shows that at some point, reason really isn't the master. It always gives way to something else. And one of those things that I think a lot of people would say is very plausible that it gives way to, that is ultimately founded on in a way, is emotion. And linked to emotion, the notion of intuition, or going by the gut. On top of this, of course, this is a view that that in some form or other, I think it's a delicate matter of interpretation how exactly he thought of it, but that Hume, of course, is often associated with. Reason is the slave of the passions, as the famous quote goes. But it's also something that's extremely hot right now in psychology, at least among certain sorts of psychologists. And I'm thinking about Drew Weston and Jonathan Haidt in particular. Of course, there's many, many more researchers working on this. According to a lot of these researchers, particularly the gentleman I just mentioned, Hume is definitely right. According to them, it's not only just the case that we often go with our emotional gut over the evidence, which we don't need psychologists to tell us. Of course, we generally do. Often we go with what we feel rather than what our reason tells us. But that, in some sense, this is hardwired into us. And in a sense, we can't even help it. And if that's the case, then the idea of praising reason, of, you know, the idea that we should try to set up our culture in a way to allow for the flourishing of the exchange and discussion of reasons is sort of a fantasy, an illusion. In fact, Jonathan Haidt calls it in his recent book, the rationalist delusion. It's an illusion to think that we should try to appeal more to reason in our political debates because, in fact, we can't. And there's a lot of data, of course, that people try to suggest is supposed to show this. There's data that, for example, Weston shows that it goes into where what the data actually shows is an interesting question, but the studies are very interesting. For example, he did a particular test where he told the participants in the test some information about a fictional case that about a military member of the U.S. military torturing some prisoners. The military guy, when questioned in the story, says that he had thought that the rules had changed, that the higher ups had told him it was okay to torture, and so he went ahead and tortured. And what they asked various questions about to what extent would you hold this guy responsible or who would you hold responsible. And this data, consistent with lots of other studies, indicates that they could predict how people would respond to these questions about responsibility and predict it with a very high degree of accuracy based on how people would react to certain other questions given to them ahead of time in a pretest, questions about, let's say, their relationship to the military. People who had a strong emotional attachments to the military tended to hold the person less responsible. And these data, this predictive powers maintained across various versions of the test. So no matter how much further data you might give data in quotes to people in order to allow them to assess the fictional story in a more rational way, that is more data about whether the guy is telling the truth and about what his higher ups told him and so forth and so on. It doesn't really matter. As if they were emotionally committed to, says Drew Weston, if they're emotionally committed to trusting the military, then they were going to answer these questions about responsibility in one way and not in another way. And so this and lots of other data seems to suggest that, you know, people's emotional reactions trump their rational reactions. Another quick example, IQ tests. If you're given an IQ test and then you're told you do well on it, then it seems apparently that you'll be more likely to want to read articles that reaffirm the efficacy of IQ tests. Right? And if you do poorly on that, or you're told you do poorly, you'll be more interested in reading articles that show that IQ tests are not reliable. So there's all sorts of interesting data out there. And what does this show us? Well, according to people like Weston and Haidt, what it shows us is that we're really emotional beings, and appeals to reason just aren't causally efficacious. Reasoning, that what we call reasoning, is actually generally post hoc rationalization. We come up with reasons for our emotional responses after the fact. Now, there's a lot of common sense here, of course. I mean, in a sense, as I said before, we don't really need fancy-smancy psychologists to tell us that, yep, we make up a lot of reasons post hoc. That's part of the human condition. And it's, we don't also need to be told that a lot of our primary initial commitments are often made because of emotional attachments. And moreover, we don't think have to think that's bad. What I think is suspicious about some of this data is the more global considerations that people draw from this. One thing that people tend to draw is that, well, these initial emotional attachments we make are themselves purely emotional. They are not infected by any sort of rational or cognitive thinking. And that's not really, it's not clear that that actually makes sense, because we can certainly, at the very least, we can say that our emotional attachments or emotional reactions are at least subject to reason. We can evaluate them. We do hold people responsible sometimes, not just for what they do, but whether what they're feeling is apt or appropriate given the situation. In the book, I give an example of if you spill a little wine on the sleeve of your dinner partner and the dinner partner gets up and screams at you for that, you might think that that's a little bit overreaction. You would hold them responsible not just for yelling at you, but in fact, you would, even if they didn't yell at you, but they felt that way, that would be right. More creepy, right?
Right. That's right.
Right. It'd be creepy it'd be almost better if they yelled at you. So right. You do hold people responsible. And I think that shows that the truth of the matter is actually a little bit more complex. Another thing I would add here is that I think, you know, go back to the example of the torture case. I mean, you know, in a sense, this too, as I said, it's not surprising that we can predict how people are going to respond to certain new pieces of information based on their core commitments. The Quine-Duhem hypothesis a long time ago got us to see that in reasoning or thinking in general, human beings are conservative in a certain sense. We resist revising our views in light of the evidence. And the fact that, for example, think about another case that Weston talks about. He points out that, you know, political partisans on either side of the political spectrum are much easier to, you know, sort of, when presented with contradictions in their, you know, let's say their favorite politician's announcements, when he's shown that their favorite politician says P and then not P later on, that at first initially provides some cognitive dissonance, but they quickly sort of come up with explanations for why this, what seems to be a contradiction, isn't a contradiction. Well, you know, again, not a surprise. Does this show that we're incapable of changing our views in light of evidence to the contrary? No. What it does show is that reason works slowly. We often start out with some core commitments, and our first reaction, as Quine and Duhem noted a long time ago, is in the face of contrary evidence to sort of try to incorporate that evidence, revise as little as possible so that we can incorporate those evidence. We try to hold on to our core commitments. That's what makes our core commitments core. But our core commitments can change. It just can take a very long time. Look at how people's attitudes towards race and gender have changed in, you know, our lifetime, for example, Bob, in certain parts of the country. These things can change. I think it's too quick to just say that what's happening here is just a sort of switch in the brain from one sort of emotional reaction to the other. So, I think it's a complicated story about how reason relates to emotion. But I think that a lot of the present data that's being bandied about, while interesting and important and, something we should pay attention to, doesn't seem to me to warrant the strong conclusions that are being drawn from it.
Right. And I suppose that it's open for one to argue. And I'm not remembering if you make this particular move in the book, but I take it that you would welcome it, that given the Quine and Duhem stuff, that how we react to unsettling or disconcerting data, and how we reconstruct and how we even rationalize or deceive ourselves, these various kinds of activities, even if they are ultimately self-deceptive, are not non-rational, right? They have a kind of instrumental rationality to them, in that in these cases, you know, people don't just stand up and start doing jumping jacks in response to disconcerting evidence. They try to figure out ways to minimize the damage done by new data.
Right.
And I suppose it could also be said that there's a kind of rationality to epistemic conservatism. There's something, you know, there are cognitive benefits to having certain sort of central kinds of beliefs be kind of steady. And so you don't want to, you know, this is, again, a good Quine-Duhem kind of point. You don't want to just give up, you know, things at the periphery of your belief system. They can change and come and go, you know, moment to moment. But the sort of central commitments, there's a kind of, you know, it might even be constitutive of being a rational creature that those don't change from moment to moment, right?
You don't want to rock your epistemic boat too much because it'll tip over and you won't know what to believe. And I think exactly right. I think that in a way, the lesson here is simple. We can all agree on that sort of point that it makes, you know, this sort of hypothesis, Quine-Duhem hypothesis about how reasoning function is a reasonable explanation of this sort of data. And it's an explanation that doesn't necessarily show that our commitments and our reluctance to revise some of those core commitments is inherently an emotional commitment only. That's really the simple point here. One further point on this. I mean, Haidt in particular, I think, has been on my mind recently. Here's a quote from his, or paraphrase from his recent book. He said something like, look, anyone who values reason, he says, this is really what he says. Anyone who values truth should stop worshiping reason. This is what he's talking about, the delusion, the reason delusion. He says, we need to look at the cold, hard look. We need to take a cold, hard look at the evidence, the scientific evidence, and see reasoning for what it is. That's just a bizarre statement on a lot of levels, right?
It sounds crazy to me.
but, I mean, it really brings out, I think, a problem that some of the more some of the more bolder positions really have here. If you're going to claim that reason never gets you to the truth, or that it's always distorted, or it's always really just a guise for emotional attachment or manipulation, then that position is going to have to apply to the very point that you're making yourself.
Exactly.
And it seems self-undermining.
Yeah, that was my initial reaction. I mean, it looked as if what was being offered was an argument for taking this this different kind of view about reason based on some psychological evidence.
Yes, but... exactly. Well, that's what it is. And so, I think this is a problem.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Let's move on. I wanted to get back to the question about what we do when we're trying to justify or reconcile ourselves to, or maybe even choose to adopt, some fundamental epistemic principles or commitments. And one of the really novel things that you propose in the book is a kind of thought experiment for thinking our way through this issue about our basic commitments. And, you know, part of what makes them basic is that you can't just exercise those very commitments in their own support, so you can't bootstrap. The move here is to appropriate, in an interesting way, a mode of argument that political philosophers such as myself are highly influenced by, introduced by John Rawls in his highly, you know, influential book, A Theory of Justice.
Yes.
Rawls famously sought to support, or maybe stronger, justify his favored conception of justice, what he called justice is fairness, which is composed of two principles of justice, by arguing that this conception or these two principles would be chosen by rational, self-interested, mainly persons who had to think about the question of justice from a very special kind of artificial condition. He called the original position, and he said that in the original position, deliberators find themselves under a veil of ignorance. They don't know what their role is going to be in the society for which they're choosing principles of justice. Now, we don't have to go into the details. Lots of people who would be listening to this know enough about Rawls that we don't have to go further. But you propose a kind of twist on this Rawlsian strategy for addressing this problem of how we justify our basic epistemic principles to ourselves. And you conceive of something like an epistemological version of the original position argument. Can you run us through that and tell us how that works?
Exactly. So the basic thrust, the conclusion of the argument that I give is that the fundamental epistemic principles that are most rational to commit to are those that would be accepted in an idealized state of social and epistemic equality. So the rational epistemic principles to commit to, the ones that we can give reasons for, are ones that meet that condition. So here's the sort of thought. I think of it as sort of like I call it the method game. And it's explicitly Rawlsian in its character, and you'll see this as I go on. So the thought is this. We're trying to figure out which of these basic epistemic principles, which are about basic epistemic methods, are rational to commit to. So suppose we have a little game. We call it the method game, where we sit around a table, and we have to make a decision about which principles we're going to privilege in some other world, W, that we're all going to later be a member of. And there's lots of things we don't know about W. We don't know what our social position is going to be in W. We don't know all the same things that we didn't know in the Rawlsian original position. We don't know our religious commitments and so forth, our education level. We're not going to know about that. We're going to join W, but we don't know any of those facts. But we also, interestingly enough, are epistemically ignorant about the W. We have no knowledge of which of these principles, epistemic principles, are going to be true in W. For all we know, W could turn out to be a Cartesian demon world, and none of our ordinary, or very few of our epistemic methods and principles are going to be reliable or true. So we're in this position of massive ignorance about W. But nonetheless, we're charged in the game. The point of the game is to actually settle on which of the principles we'll privilege. By privilege, I just simply mean which of the ones we're going to commit to in W. And privilege is a practical matter. It's a matter of which of these principles are going to be taught in the schools, which are going to be used to adjudicate differences and appeals for research money and the like. So we've got to make this decision about W. Now, when we come to play the game, those sitting around the table, now we're not in W, we're in alpha. So in alpha, in the actual world, we can appeal to whatever epistemic principles and methods we'd like, but we have to abide by certain rules of the game. And those rules are these. When arguing in alpha for which principles to privilege in W, we can't, because of the levels of ignorance that I talked about before, it's against the rules of the game to present epistemic reasons, direct or indirect epistemic reasons, for favoring the principle. So I can't say to you, for example, look, we've got to trust such and such a method because I know this method's reliable here, and so it's probably going to be reliable there. I also can't say things like, well, God has told me that this consulting the book is reliable here. And I can't say that, well, therefore it's going to be reliable in W either. I might think that, but those aren't the sorts of reasons that we're allowed to give each other in the game to persuade each other to adopt one principle or another. So once you can put these constraints in question, it's an interesting sort of exercise to think about what sorts of reasons we could appeal to try to persuade each other. And what I find that we're going to do is we're going to start appealing to Reasons for favoring principles that are obviously not epistemic, but are tracking the sorts of things that we do know and we do think are important for anyone, any self-interested person who's going to join W. Here's an example of what I mean. I think it's going to be when considering, you know, competing principles in Alpha, when sitting around the table of the method game, it's going to be, I think, natural for people to first say, well, look, we do know, I didn't add this earlier, but we do know that the inhabitants of W are going to be human beings. That you do know. So we can at least say that they are going to employ things like sense perception. Now, we don't know whether sense perception is going to be reliable. It could be a Cartesian demon world, but we do know that they're going to use it. So we might as well privilege these methods that they're going to use just because of their hardwiring, so to speak. We might as well privilege those off of the bat because we're not going to be able to really help but use those. Then the real questions are going to be about whether we should use those as trumping principles or not. Should we, in a sense, favor the ones that we all have to use because we're human beings? And I think the answer is quickly going to suggest that we probably will. One of the things that we're going to – the reason for that is because if we all, in virtue of being human beings, have certain abilities and therefore are going to be able to use certain methods, then because I'm not going to know who I'm going to turn out to be in W, it's going to be attractive to me to privilege the methods that I know that I am going to be able to appeal to. I'm going to be less attracted to privileging methods, if I'm self-interested, that, let's say, only allow the access to the truth or what we think is the truth by a privileged few, because I don't know whether I'm going to be in that privileged few. So I think we're going to favor methods that are transparent, widely accessible, public in a certain way, and have various other virtues of that sort.
Excellent. I guess I'm just thinking sort of off the cuff at this point about whether your appeal to this, again, modified but very roughly Rawlsian framework doesn't inherit some of the standard and by now textbook kinds of objections that political philosophers have brought against Rawls. And one of the things that you do in the book, I think very effectively, is after you introduce this method game set of considerations, you do run through some of the questions that people who might be either critics or at least willing to think about criticizing the approach, what they might say. Could you walk us through one or two of what you think are the more either obvious or compelling critical moves that someone might make?
Right. Well, one thing I think one thing people will say, I think, right off the bat, if, you know, people who've read Michael Sandel and the like, you know, his criticisms of Rawls, will say, well, look, you know, one, you seem to be, your method game seems to require us to strip our, you know, put aside considerations that are important to our identity as human beings and appeal to these very abstract, minimal considerations. And that's just not very realistic. It's not, among other things, it's not very realistic. People can't put aside such aspects of their identity in order to, you know, engage in this sort of discussion. Just not possible. That, I think, might be a legitimate criticism of Rawls, although I'm not, you know, I think the matter's jury's still out. It depends on how one under which Rawls we're talking about. Right. But putting aside Rawls, it's definitely not an issue for me. And I think it's important to mention this because I think this is crucial to understanding what's going on. When I think about, and the difference between what I'm doing and Rawls is doing, when I say, you know, what we're doing when we're doing sitting down in the method game is figuring out which methods we're going to privilege in this ideal, in this other world. I am definitely allowing, and I have to allow, that people sitting around the table playing the game in the actual world are, of course, going to be using methods in forming their beliefs about which methods to privilege that they think are reliable. So, for example, you'll probably, even though you can't appeal to the reliability of deductive inference to show that it's a good method to privilege in W, you can't appeal to its reliability for getting at the truth. You probably do think it's reliable and will use it as reliable, and you will therefore use it for that reason when arguing, for example, for or against various principles that are suggested during the method game. But
right.
That's perfectly fine. There's no problem with that at all. So in my game, it's not that we're minimal cells shrinking to a vanishing point in terms of our identity behind the veil of ignorance. Rather, I imagine us as full – we're talking about – the people involved in the game are full-blown individuals with all the various complicated commitments that full-blown individuals actually have. So that's one reason. Another reason to be skeptical about the game. Another reason, another basic argument you might make, which I think is, you know, I don't think we'll be able to get into too much, but I think I'll lay it on the table, is that, look, the method game shows us at best practical reasons for favoring certain basic epistemic principles, but didn't really we want, skeptic or no skeptic, don't we want some epistemic reasons for favoring our epistemic principles? Isn't that really the prize? And what I do show in the book, what I argue in the book, I think that's a legitimate point to think that, in a sense, what I'm giving people is stone instead of bread. What I argue in the book is that, although, as I've already said, skepticism has to be acknowledged as really removing the possibility of providing an ultimate epistemic grounding of our epistemic principles, despite Descartes' heroic attempt. There are the principles and the reasons that I give for in the course of the method game thought experiment turn out to have epistemic relevance, at least, in a very interesting way. And it's a very indirect and roundabout way, but one way of putting it is this. I think that if we privilege the methods that would be accepted in this idealized state of epistemic and social equality, we'll find that those methods, which turn out to have these democratic virtues, are going to be methods that, because they have these democratic virtues, not because they have epistemic virtues, but because they have certain democratic virtues, are actually going to be able to, for that very reason, be employed in societies that can be set up to have a effective, epistemically effective system. So, in other words, what we want in a society is some sort of epistemic distribution of labor. We can't all be experts on everything. So people have to have the experts in certain things. And in order to do that, we have to trust each other that, you know, we're actually sort of in developing our expertise, we're relying on the right sort of methods. So we need to have some reasons for that trust. The reasons that we have for the trust, according to my argument, are these practical reasons, but they're reasons all the same. And as a result, they are reasons for setting up a society that has this division of labor. And any society that does have a division of labor in this way is going to be a more effective society for acquiring vis-a-vis acquiring knowledge than one that doesn't.
Excellent. We are running out of time, but I do want to, if it's okay with you, just ask about one other element of the book. If you've got a few extra minutes, it's okay. Okay, good. So, the book ends with a discussion or a return to an issue which you said at the very beginning of our conversation has occupied you since the beginning of your career. You've written extensively and influentially about truth. In the book, In Praise of Reason, you close with a chapter on truth and the pathos of distance. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, and then this is asking you to encapsulate a lot, and then to say something about your pluralist conception of truth.
Oh, okay, sure. The problem that I raise at the end of the book is an attempt to undermine or be skeptical about reason that is different than the ones we've talked about. I mean, one reason that people might be skeptical about reason nowadays is that they see reason, and particularly the way I've been talking about it, is the set of practices that are encoded in scientific inquiry, as based on an illusion of a certain sort, namely that it's based on the illusion that there is such a thing as an objective truth that we might be aiming at. And this seems particularly, this sort of skepticism seems particularly relevant because the sorts of, reasons I've been giving for reasons throughout the book at this point are philosophical reasons. And one might think that if there's any place that we should be suspicious that we're getting at any sort of objective truth, it's in philosophy. And at least that's what a lot of people think. Maybe not philosophers, but lots of people. Sure. So there's this sort of, this worry that in a sense that the book, the sort of practical reasons and so forth that I'm giving, moral reasons, these sorts of reasons are if any reasons are unobjective. And so my defense of reason is itself riddled through with subjectivity. And that's the sort of worry I have at the end. But it brings up a lot of other issues that you rightly say I've been talked about before, and that is just questions of what truth is in general. I tend to think that that people, philosophers who think about truth, tend to fall into two camps. There's those who think that there's one single nature of truth, a real essence of truth, maybe it's correspondence, maybe it's coherence. And then there's those philosophers who think that because attempts to say what the real essence of truth have failed and failed so miserably across the history of philosophy, what we really should do is acknowledge that there really is no such thing as the essence of truth and that truth doesn't have a nature. And that thought is a powerful one. And Richard Rorty, I think, among other philosophers, have made it very forcefully, and of course, a whole host of more technically oriented philosophers, such as Hartree Field or Paul Horwich. I think both of those views are mistaken. I think it's a sort of example where philosophers sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that while it's true that maybe not every, it's right to think that the real essence of truth might not be correspondence. It's wrong to think that truth has no essence. The better way to think of it is it has more than one. There's different kinds of truth, is the view that I maintain. And the full defense of this is in a different book, in a book called Truth is One of Many. But in Praise of Reason, I try to use this theory. I marshal it to try to answer this objection that I noted before by essentially saying that, look, the sorts of reasons, practical reasons that we give each other in the method game and in everyday life, these reasons do aim at the truth. They just aim at a different kind of truth than correspondence with the fact. And this kind of truth is fully worthy of the name of truth because truth is itself a functional notion, a notion that can be multiply realized. This, of course, takes a lot of argument, but it holds out the promise of a very exciting picture of how what Sellars called the manifest image of ourselves is related to what he also called the scientific images of ourselves, not as fundamentally incoherent or, inconsistent, but rather as images of different kinds of truth. And I think that's the sort of thing that we need to appreciate if we're going to appreciate that reason, practical reason or theoretical reason, always aims at the truth, even if it's not always aiming at the same kind of truth.
Well, excellent. That was a very elegant summary of some very complicated philosophical thoughts, and I think you did a great job. So we're at the end of our time. You've been very, very generous. So one last question, and then we'll sign off. What are you up to next? Sometimes I hate asking people who've just published a book what the next thing is. Maybe this doesn't give them a breather, but can you tell us a little bit about what's coming next?
Okay, I have a few things that I'm working on. I have been, for a while out of the truth game, but, every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. I am busily revamping some of that pluralist theory of truth for some lectures, the Brain Korea lectures that I'm giving in South Korea next week,
wonderful.
Actually. So I'm writing a new series called the series of lectures is going to be called The Varieties of Truth. And this is referencing a quote from Sellars. But I have longer term projects that are just to briefly describe them. One is an offshoot of the project that I just, in Praise of Reason project. I'm interested in the fact that we're, you know, the internet, this sort of puzzle that I think a lot of people are interested in now, the internet, Google, for example, seems to have expanded our knowledge in one sense. But in another sense, it seems to be shrinking it. And right. Because we were running out of time, I won't expand that too much, but hopefully that'll give you the taste of the puzzle that I'm interested in. And I think what I'm interested in is what that tells us about what knowledge is. And then there's a longer term project that I'm interested in. I've been interested in my whole intellectual life, which is the nature of the imagination. I've just written a book on reason. I'm also interested in imagination. And I think the two aren't, you know, we might think there's a diametrically opposed. I mean, there's the, you know, reason is what tells us like it is, and imagination is the part of us that makes stuff up.
Right.
And I think that's too simplistic of a way of dividing things, and I want to dive more into the imagination to see if I'm right about that.
Well, those both sound like interesting projects, and good luck with the trip and with the lectures, and we'll be keeping an eye out for what you've been working on or what you'll be working on in the future. Thanks so much for your time, and thanks for talking to us about In Praise of Reason.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Okay, take care now.
Take care.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Michael Lynch of the University of Connecticut. We've been talking about his new book, In Praise of Reason, published by the MIT Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.